if you're innovating, creating, or making a difference.
This show is for you. Welcome to Over Coffee. I'm Dot Cannon. Here on Over Coffee, we talk with artists and innovators about the process of changing the world in terms of what they do.
People see that as funny, and that's something that I realized as I was talking to other people about the book. They thought it was a comedy.
What if you were overweight in a nation in which being obese was considered a criminal offense? That's the world author Philip C. Barragan II creates in his new novel, Fatizen 24602. It's a great read, dark and humorous by turns, and it's really going to make you question some of the ways we think about weight and our society. Philip, let's start your story at the beginning here. What do you remember very best about growing up in the San Fernando Valley?
I remember the hot summers in the valley, and as a child, they were very long, and my days with my best friend, Lance, who lived across the street, and we had all kinds of adventures. It's really what stuck out, just the incredible summers I had growing up.
Sounds like that might have fueled your imagination for what you would later create.
I think it did. We were, my friend Lance and I, we never had a boring day. Every day was filled with, what can we do today? We made clothes for dolls for our friends. We had amusement park rides. We built Lego amusement parks. Everything was centered around fun and very, very handcrafted fun.
When did you first realize that writing was something you really loved to do too?
I loved writing throughout school, although I had trouble finishing books through my teens, funny enough. But I loved writing, and I never really pursued it because I thought my future was going to be in the visual arts. And I used to love to paint and draw, and I went to art schools on Saturdays while attending regular college. But I never really thought writing was going to be where I was going to go.
And what changed to take you back to it?
Well, I left college in 1991, and for about 15 years, I worked in social work and didn't explore writing at all, but was very much surrounded by other writers and was always inspired when they finished a project. I used to think to myself, I could do that too. And when I decided to go back to college and finish my undergraduate work at Antioch University in Los Angeles, that's when I realized this is what I want to do. I wanted to write, and it just felt right. It felt the timing was on target, and I had the ability to focus, and the more I read as an adult, that got a lot easier, and the more I read, the more I realized I wanted to tell stories myself.
Tell me the story of beginning to create Fatizen 24602. How'd that happen for you?
I was in a creative writing class, and my professor encouraged me to be as creative as I could be the whole class. And it was very, very much personalized education, not very large classes at all. And so I decided to go on a limb and write the story that had been lingering in my head about a real dystopian world where being fat was outlawed. And I decided to take it to an extreme. And I wanted to show what happens when you repress part of human nature, how it comes out in other ways that can be very unexpected, and just take it to its ultimate ridiculous conclusion. That was the genesis of the story.
And you tell the story with a wonderful main character, Delilah Palladino. Who was your inspiration for her?
Well, friends of mine have asked if that's me in drag. And I had to respond, well, no, actually, it's very much not. I wanted to write it from a woman's point of view because I really feel women have a much harder time in society regarding size. Society is much more forgiving for men, I think, in general. But women wear a much heavier stigma, no pun intended. It's much harder for a woman to be large and fat in our society. And I thought that would be the point of view that I wanted to show. And actually, Delilah is a combination of many people, a combination of my mother, my grandmother, friends that I've known, and in all the interviews that I did with women to get a real woman's point of view. Every situation that Delilah encounters in the book, I have spoken to someone and got several responses from all different kinds of people. How would a woman react in this situation? And surprisingly enough, it was a lot different than I thought. And I realized as a writer, it's easy to take a character and let the character do what you want that person to do. But Delilah, as you know, many great characters, if I can color that, you know, develop, decided to write her own story, and I tried to be authentic to how a woman would really respond in that situation.
She's a wonderful character. She's gutsy, she's funny, she's loving. She's the kind of person you would really want in your corner if you had to do something like launch a classic good and evil battle.
Thank you. That's kind of where I wanted to go with her. I wanted people to be on her side. I wanted people to cheer her on. And I wanted her to be vulnerable and imperfect. And that's one of the things I learned in school. You have to allow your character to get beat up. And I did, but I think in the end, it makes for a much stronger, much more real character.
Tell me about the time involved in doing interviews with all these women. How many and over what time did you have to do to get as authentic a character as you have?
Oh, wow. I would say I did a good 2 to 3 years of interviewing different people, different coworkers and friends and family. And I did that actually after I wrote the first draft. I wanted to have some kind of basis to work from. And once I completed that, then each scene, every encounter that she has, I would talk to one of these individuals and say, okay, this is what's happening. How would you react in this situation? And I listened to what they said, and it really surprised me, some of their responses. And some of the research was very surprising, and particularly when it was woman-on-woman interaction. And I realized that people can be cruel, more so than I had anticipated writing. But, you know, human nature can go very dark. And so I let the story go there. And so it was really about 2 to 3 years over the course of writing the book, which actually took a total of 7 years.
In fact, that answered a question I had, because you yourself have spent your life helping people and a background of very compassionate work, yet you do go to some very dark places. For example, the scene where Kevin, let's not ruin it, but I'll just say where he has some tough start roughing him up at Gordo's restaurant.
Yes, that was particularly hard to do. And again, without having any kind of spoiler, again, I went back to one of the lessons I learned in grad school was let your characters get beat up. And I did. And I have to admit, after I finished writing that scene, I was in tears. Because you become so attached to characters. And after every torturous scene that's in the book, it was a bit emotional. But I feel that if it could bring me to tears as I'm writing it, then hopefully it's going to have some kind of momentous effect for the reader, some kind of impact. And I hope that came through.
It certainly did. But I'll bet you weren't in tears when you wrote about Mimi, who seems pure evil. What makes her tick?
I looked at all different kinds of villains. I did research on all the different kinds of antagonists that are out there. And I didn't want her to be a typical two-dimensional character. Yes, you know, she had to be, you know, the villain of the story. But I wanted to show what made her the person that she is. You know, what kind of situations would create someone so bent on one point of view, very much a Hitler-minded individual that embraced a philosophy so in such a focused way that everything seemed to justify that direction and that course of action. And I looked at different individuals that I knew in my own life that had those characteristics, and I spent a lot of time looking at what motivates those individuals. And I found that it's our lives and the experiences that we've been through, in addition to a predisposition for that mindset. I think someone has to have the wiring to be able to embrace that kind of dictatorial, maniacal behavior. I don't think a sane individual, regardless of, you know, a lifetime of horrific actions, I think you have to kind of be wired to go that direction. And then, you know, a few good, you know, punches from life, and the person is on that journey.
And Rhonda seems like a really good foil for her, too. Is she willfully blind, or what's going on with her?
I wanted to let Rhonda follow her heart. I know a lot of individuals who believe blindly when they're in love, and love can really blind us to the reality of what's in front of us. And for Rhonda, I wanted to show that, you know, believing so earnestly with your heart, you know, can take you to some very undesirable places. And she's one of the more tragic characters that I wrote, but I didn't want her to be weak. I didn't want her to be solely just a punching bag. I wanted to write her with strength and a history of strength in spite of, you know, what ends up happening to her.
And again, I won't spoil it, but she's a really fun character. Makes me kind of wonder if there might be a sequel to Fadison 24602.
Actually, there will be. This is the first in a trilogy. And I hadn't thought about that while I was writing it. And again, it's hard to talk about this without doing any spoilers, but at the end of the story, I really had to figure out and decide ahead of time, is this a one-time shot, or do the characters continue, some of them anyway, and what happens? And so, yes, there is a second book. The second book will be the 10-year span that the book takes in the middle, between parts one and two. So what happened in those 10 years? And so that's going to be book two. And then book three would be the continuation of the storyline from where the first left off.
Definitely something to look forward to reading.
Thank you.
What were the mechanics of the creative process like for you when you expanded your short story into the book, the first draft that you referred to?
Well, the story was really 25 pages of the more twisted part of the story. It was showing a vignette of this character named Delilah. And actually, it was a series of vignettes of several different characters, including what I call the feast, which is highlighted in part two. And just letting my pen have fun, and just in a very twisted kind of way. And when I took that story and decided, okay, is there something better here? Is there something worth telling? And what would be the interesting story? And a mentor of mine helped me pull apart and choose elements that actually were worthwhile. And all these other characters, not interesting, dump them. The only one that has anything to say is Delilah. Choose her and rewrite this. And he said, this is her story. Focus on that. And that will lead you to a book. And so I did. And I looked at the places that I wanted her to go and tell the story. And when I realized that what I had was not so much just a simple satire but really was a novel that could fit into the realm of social justice, of right and wrong, and what people do to each other and the hope for a better world. That was the book and the genesis of the story, and looking at what creates us as people, and then let the story go from there.
An interesting side note when you refer to what people do and how we behave to each other is that on your blog, you have a post where you quote a coach in St. Louis. His comment is so over the top and so cruel that it sounds like it could have come from Mimi's lips and this was real life. What do you tell people about, as somebody who's been an activist for people of size, about dealing with that kind of attitude?
Well, it's a tough world, and I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut. But not everyone is built that way, and not everyone has the ability to stand up for what they passionately believe in, and especially a lot of people of size. That is real, real tough. And I learned that a long time ago, which is why I actually, back in the 90s, I started a group with a friend of mine for large men, big, heavy, large men of size, fat men. I'm very empowered to use the word fat as a descriptor, not a judgment, and create a safe place for people of size to gather and explore ways to help eliminate the shame involved in being fat, because there is so much shame in the size community. You know, we are taught from the time we are young that fat is bad, and it's been a lifetime work of mine, from being out there to more subtle ways to address this shame issue, that there should be no shame and how big or small we are. It's about who we are inside. And for those of us that are big, that we can be beautiful, productive, fascinating people of size. And, you know, size is the exterior, but it's not something to be appreciated in spite of. We should be appreciated for all that we are. And there are people out there who appreciate all that we are, regardless of size. And that's really been my goal in life, to help individuals embrace life and not hide in the shadows.
Delilah is certainly the kind of heroine to bring that across, too. I love how you put that into a character in your book. What would you like writers to learn from you about the creative process and creative discipline in getting a book written? Because I understand you wrote this while you were working full-time?
Yes, I've been working full-time without stopping through the whole process. And it's tough. You know, I've seen movies and commercials where people talk about quitting their job and writing the next great American novel. Not all of us have the luxury to do that. And most of us, as many of my friends will attest, those of us who are not independently wealthy, we have to work. We have to pay rent and our bills. But that doesn't preclude, you know, anyone from achieving this goal. And for me, as a writer, I knew I wanted to tell my story, and I felt that it was worthwhile to work for and to get it out there. And just believing so passionately in this project kept me going. I realized when I graduated from grad school that the time I had carved out in my schedule to do my homework was going to be my writing time. And that was getting up extra early, and which means 4 o'clock. And that's hard because I'm not a morning person. So I can get an hour worth of writing in the morning before I leave for work, and then an hour at lunchtime at work, and making sure that those times are sacred and holding to that because it's that important. And that was really tough because at work I love to go to lunch with my coworkers, and I love the morning news, and I love my breakfast in the morning before I leave for work. So it was tough when I had the realization, so this time for school is really my writing time. But staying focused, and with the help of my husband, Mason, who was the artist and illustrator for the book, he was able to be that support in that schedule to keep me on track and keep me going, making sure that my lunch was packed for work and that I had my tea in the morning when I was writing. And that really made that happen. And I'm so appreciative, you know, for that support and for my boss and my coworkers who were all very supportive in the process. So it really, without being cliche and talking about it takes a village, it takes a really good support system, I think, to make this happen. And if you, it doesn't have to be huge. As long as I think you have people who are on your side and have your best interests, you know, at heart, you know, women with families who work and have cared for children. And I told them I admired them because they were able and are continually able to work full-time, raise their children, and some of them with really small children, and still create art. I think that's admirable. I think I'm lucky that I don't have children in that respect because I can be selfish and just look at what I have to do.
And it is great to have somebody support you that far. Now, what about working with Mason? Because he did the illustrations, as you mentioned. What was that like for you and for him, getting the story out there and getting his illustrations with it?
That was a little bit tricky. Mason, when we decided to pursue our relationship, then to work together in some fashion, he wanted to do a graphic novel with the story. And we talked about doing just a graphic novel, and I thought, well, no, I've been working on this project for so long, it needs to be a book in its own right. And we talked with, when we got our publisher, we had discussions with them about, okay, how can we do this? So we decided to take 18 of the full-page illustrations and put them throughout the book, you know, one every other chapter or so, and allow that to be kind of like an old-fashioned approach to books when there used to be illustrations in books, and give individuals a taste of the graphic novel. And that is actually the project that we are working on right now, finishing up part one of the graphic novel, which is part one of the book that should be out this year. And it's been really exciting to see Mason interpret the scenes, you know, through his vision. And it's wonderful to see it come to life in that way.
I'm intrigued looking at the illustrations because it struck me as I was reading that the one time that he's drawn Mimi and made her actually look beautiful is the time that she shows some humanity, the time that, well, I won't say what, but there's a point in the book where you actually feel sorry for Mimi.
Yes, and that was part of showing her humanity. She is a human, and she has feelings. And no villain, no antagonist, unless they are 100% sociopathic, they are flesh and blood human beings, very twisted and with a lot of other adjectives. But it was important to show she is human and she feels and she can cry and she can hurt. That was important to show. And I think Mason captured that pretty well.
I don't want to spoil what goes on here by telling any more of the story, but I wish you'd continue your story for me of getting Fantasy 24602 published. Was it an instant hit and the publisher said, oh, yes, I'll take it, or what happened for you?
Well, I spent a considerable amount of time. I think I spent about a year marketing to publishers and agents trying to get someone interested in the project. And that was a lot harder than I thought. I really didn't anticipate the difficulty, but as I've learned, and it's all a learning process, most every writer, goes through quite an ordeal to get their first novel published. And after rejections from both publishers and agents, a friend of mine that I went to school with told me about the small press in Vermont that published her book, and it's actually someone that she had gone to school with for undergraduate studies, and her friend said, I'm going to create my own publishing company. And she did. And so when I contacted Branch Hill Publications, it was a vetting process. They wanted, like all the other publishing companies, show me the first 25 pages and the last 25 pages. And then after talking to them about the book and my project, they asked for the whole thing. And then they decided it was something they wanted to do. And I was thrilled. I was thrilled that it took this really small press to see the value in the book. And that's how we got on the road to publication.
That had to have been the world's most wonderful feeling.
It was. It was a validation of my project, of, you know, what I wanted to do. And they believed in it so fiercely. In fact, Jim Fires, one of the two, our publishing company, he sent me this beautiful email once we were finished with the process and it was going to print. He said, thank you for allowing me to participate in this journey. You know, he called himself an old hippie, and being able to march again for something so positive. And this is the kind of project that he was waiting for to, you know, to believe in. And it was a real, it was very touching. And I'm so pleased that I've been able to participate in something that I really think is bigger than me. You know, it came out of my head, you know, flavored with the input from many people. But that it's something that makes a point and addresses an injustice. And I really, I see this making a much bigger impact once I get enough individuals informed of the book, that enough people read the book and hear Delilah, watch Delilah, and see what she goes through. I anticipate a continued momentum of impact on the story of sadism. And I'm real excited by that because I see that happening. Individuals that I speak with are so enthusiastic. And people who actually are not even anywhere involved with the FAT movement or the FIES movement. Mason's sister, who read the book, she was so enthralled with the story. And she is not a big person at all. But I realized it's more than just about size. It's about people. And it's about family. And, you know, being told that you're not good enough. And I think we've all had that experience.
I'm nodding my head in agreement here because you could hear the echoes of maybe somebody in high school saying that you didn't look that good that day, even if you were fat or not. Or you could hear the echoes of someone who was jealous of you in the workplace or anything of that nature. So it really does hit home. When you say get involved in the FAT movement, what kind of action would you really love to see your readers take after they've read Fat is in 24602? They're inspired. They want to do something. What do they do?
I would love for individuals to talk about these issues, to bring up the subject at work, or if around the water cooler at work, or around the cubicle, that there are discussions, comments made about people of size, which happen all the time. It's one of the last areas that people feel safe to make jokes about. I mean, fat jokes, you can hear them every day. You know, people are diminished, you know, from the comments of others. And it's, you know, beyond everything else, fat is the ultimate four-letter word. And I would like people to address that, to ask, what are you making by that statement? You know, call people on their actions. And I think people feel free, beyond any other kind of joke, people feel free to poke fun at fat people. And people see fat as funny. And that's something that I realized as I was talking to other people about the book, that they thought it was a comedy. And when I explained that it's, you know, there may be scenes that, you know, I write in some humor, but it's not a funny story, people are surprised. They really think it's going to be a farce. And that's the way we have seen fat portrayed in the media and stories for years, that, you know, fat is funny. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote Delilah's husband as a very hunky individual. And then Mason picked up on that as well, that You know, the fat girl has the hot husband. And that actually happens. It's not something that is rare or unique. And talking to people, exploring, having friends of all different sizes, you know, those individuals that have allowed themselves to live life fully and date and get out in the world, and who are women of size, big, beautiful women, you know, very frequently have these very handsome partners, and they are not at a loss for the enjoyment of living. You know, they live life fully. And I wanted to show that, you know, in the case of Delilah, she is not hiding in a closet avoiding the world. You know, she embraces life and makes no apologies for who she is, what she looks like, and what she likes.
In fact, she would be somebody I think just about anybody reading would love to have for a best friend. She's just an amazing character.
Thank you.
You mentioned that your graphic novel will be out later this year. Do you have a projected date?
Yes, it'll definitely be out by November. I'm in the process now of lettering the pages. I'm on page 45, and there's about 200 pages in part one of the graphic novel. That part one is going to be huge enough on its own and Mason's well further into the story than that. And we have someone coloring, Sean Lake. He is our colorist, and bringing the pages to life with vivid color. It'll definitely be out by November, and going to be with Branch Hill again. That was a project they wanted to take on. And so we are daily working on this and very excited, you know, as the project moves forward with quite a lot of momentum.
Let's give your website where people can find out more and also about any readings you might have coming up.
Great. Yes, the website, simply enough, is www.fatizen.com. That's F-A-T-I-Z-E-N. And there are links to all of the different associated pages. I have a link to Delilah's own blog where she sends messages from the future about her world and what she's going through. And there's a link to the YouTube videos. We've created two 60-second book trailers utilizing Mason's artwork from the graphic novel, and it gives a real flavor to where we're going with the story. And as for readings, I'll be reading this month on June 26th. I will be reading at Book Show. It's in Highland Park in Los Angeles. And it's on a Friday night at 7:30. I'll be reading with three individuals that I went to school with, really talented, incredible writers, for an evening of dystopian nightmares, readings of Love and Murder in America is the title of the evening. And then I'll be reading at Gatsby Books in July, negotiating a date. And Gatsby Books will be the exclusive bookstore in Long Beach selling Fatizen once we get all the details taken care of. So I'm real excited to be working with Sean at Gatsby Books. That's the latest bookstore that is looking at carrying the novel. So good things, real exciting. And the dates for the Gatsby reading in Long Beach will be on the website once we get all that stuff taken care of.
Fatizen.com. And finally, Philip, what would you most like people to get from you and from Delilah, Mimi, Mark, Kevin, all of your characters about innovation, creativity, and making a difference?
I really feel that everyone should embrace all parts of themselves, to realize that there should be no shame in who you are or your dreams or your goals, that happiness is out there for everyone. Success is out there. If you have a dream, reach for it and do it and never put off until you look a certain way, until you've lost a few pounds, you know, whether that's love or work or, you know, any kind of goal. I think as human beings, we want to wait until the right moment, but there never is a right moment. It's always the present, and just move forward and reach out and start. You know, with our world the way it is, and that is lots of positives and negatives all around us. You know, I'm happy enough to get to work in one piece, not getting into an accident on the freeway. And I would never want to stop, you know, any one of the projects that I'm doing. You know, we never know how long we have on this planet. And with life being so short, and the older I get, the shorter it seems, I hope the message people take away from Fatism and all that I've put into it is that believing in yourself and never letting anyone tell you you're not good enough and doing it and finishing it. I think that's so important and so vital to achieving happiness. You know, you can have all the dreams that you want, but success happens when you make those dreams take root and come alive and make them happen. And that's when I think we reach that state of success and happiness.
Philip, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Matt. I really appreciate your time and the ability to join you on your pod. Thank you.
You and I have been listening to Philip C. Barragan II, author of the new book, Fatism 24602. You'll find more information, along with a blog by Philip's main character, Delilah Palladino, on his website, fatism.com. That's fatism.com, spelling that F-A-T-I-Z-E-N. And as he mentioned, Philip's doing a reading from his book this upcoming Friday evening, June 26th, at 7:30. That's happening at Book Show on North Figueroa Street near Avenue 55 in Highland Park. Also, the date has now been announced for his Gatsby's reading in Long Beach. That's Saturday, July 11th. Once again, you'll find more information on the website, fatism.com. Now, here's my question for you. How have you seen other people's attitudes towards weight affect your life? If you have time, I'd love for you to email me an answer to that question at twomavericks@gmail.com. That's two, T-W-O, Mavericks, M-A-V-E-R-I-X, @gmail.com. I may read your answer on a future Over Coffee podcast. All responses become property of Two Mavericks Multimedia, and unfortunately, I can't pay you for submissions. Once again, the question to which I'd like a response from you, how have you seen other people's attitudes towards weight affect your life? Our email address once again, twomavericks@gmail.com. And that concludes this edition of Over Coffee. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more Over Coffee podcasts, our link is twomavericks.com. That's twomavericks.com. And you can contact us at twomavericks@gmail.com. The music you're hearing is royalty-free production music provided by Pond5 at pond5.com. I'm Dot Cannon. Here's wishing you a cappuccino day.